From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the Finger Lakes, where, for the first time, Wine Enthusiast magazine has selected its International Winemaker of the Year. The magazine holds its annual Wine Star Awards. The Winemaker of the Year typically comes from California or France, not always. Past winners have come from South Africa, Italy, Washington State, but never the Finger Lakes, not until now. The 2021 International Winemaker of the Year is Fred Merworth of Herman J. Wiemer on Seneca Lake. Now, to be fair, even winemakers have mixed feelings about glossy wine magazines. I'll speak for myself when I say those magazines do a lot of good, but for years they've also been pretty narrowly focused. Another cover story on Gigal or Mondavi will sell a lot of magazines, but it's not all that interesting to people who have been following wine. Wine scores are another bone of contention. I'm not a big fan of declaring that this wine is exactly 94 points, but not 95, definitely not 93. But again, scores sell products, and for some consumers, I guess that's helpful. All of which is to say the wine media has expanded its gaze in the last decade or so. And wineries like Herman J. Wiemer, it's one of the reasons why. You can't ignore the quality of what they do, whether you were born in Yates County or whether you grew up in Bordeaux. Fred Merworth has become a very good friend of mine. So listeners might want to take this conversation with a bit of a grain of salt, admittedly. We coach our son's baseball teams together. Mostly Fred coaches and I rake the infield, but it's technically a team effort. But our friendship grew when I was first writing about the region, and I came to respect what he and Marisa and Oscar and the entire Wiemer team were doing. And given how much he loves talking about himself, well, I figured he'd love to come in to the WEOS studios and join Connections. So we say, Fred Merworth, 2021 Winemaker of the Year in Wine Enthusiast Magazine, welcome to Connections.
Thank you, Evan. This is fantastic to be here, and I hope we continue to coach together after this.
This may be the end of the partnership.
Right.
This could be the end. You love talking about yourself, so I'm just going to walk away. You can just have the floor for an hour. How's that sound?
Perfect.
Yeah, it's, yeah. I should actually say, Fred, when you won this award, I reached out, and I thought it should be you, Marisa, Oscar, Dylan, the whole team, because I know that you are a team guy, and I know that, you know, there's a little bit of discomfort in just talking about yourself, but they insisted that this really is your award and that it ought to be your voice this hour, and I just wanted you to know that. Congratulations on the award, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I tried to drag Oscar and Marisa into it, and they continued to drag their feet because they're saying it is about you. I said, no, it really isn't. It is a full team effort, and we'll get to that. But I tried to drag them in. I did.
I know you did. Just for the record, I know you did. When did you find out that? First of all, when did you find out you were under consideration, and when did you find out that you had won this award?
The nomination came through in early September, and you know we were gearing up for harvest. So I'll be honest, I didn't think much of it at the moment because I'm like, this is great, but it's raining again.
Yeah.
And so it was certainly, you know, I reflected at the time and said, this is great. We had been nominated for a winery award a number of years ago and it, you know, that is phenomenal. It really is. It continues to bring recognition to the region and to us. Maybe the first week of October, Teresa Kelly, who's our artistic director, she came to me and said, hey, you have to call Adam Strum from Wine Enthusiast. And that was sort of the tale there. And I said, okay, between the rain and the tonnage that we're pressing, I'll give him a ring, certainly. And so I gave him a call, and we actually played phone tag a couple times. And finally, he told me over the phone. And you know, I don't think it totally sunk in at the time. We were in the middle of harvest and just, you know, grapes are swirling around. And in that moment, I really didn't have much to say to Adam besides thank you, and this is unbelievable. I'm still a little in shock. That's not the word, but I'm still, trying to grasp what that means for us in the region, and it's all very exciting, certainly.
Well, Fred, I mean, you obviously know that if you are born in Europe in a winemaking family, your path is often set. There's a lot of family operations that go generation to generation. Not always, but that is often how it happens in Europe. In this country, that's not so much how it happens. And I want to talk a little bit about your path here. I mean, I know you and I have talked a lot about this. We've written about this. But for listeners who don't know the story, when did you first see yourself in wine as a career?
Well, I went to Cornell in horticulture and ag business, and I was coming off of a family farm operation that I grew up on, and my parents and sisters and aunt and uncle were running a very successful dairy farm, and decided to move on from the dairy and into other agriculture and have a farm store. And midway through my freshman year, I went home for Christmas, and as a family, we decided that we weren't going to be in agriculture in the sphere that I had imagined going back to a family farm in. I would say that was the life change, if you will, of, okay, well, my path forward, I envisioned being this, and now that is closed. So what is the path? And I can say that at Cornell for a year and a half, I was probably wandering just a little bit. Well, what does post-graduation look like? And so I spent a semester in Germany to try to figure that out. And I spent a day with our professor and a group of students in Alsace. And we went to a small producer called Emily Bayer in Eggesheim. And we spent the morning tasting and walking through the old cellar. And that was the moment for me that, people talk about that aha moment, or that moment where you come to realize that things that you were searching for are right in front of you. And that was it. It combined the love of agriculture, a lifestyle, if you will, in terms of working land and being involved in your product so passionately that there wasn't a divide between the two, that they were kind of seamlessly combined. And I found that really enticing and just kind of like that aha moment of, this is it. And so when I came back to Cornell,
can I pop in just for a sec? Because what you're describing, you know, sometimes people who are on a wine tour or just tasting, they'll go into big glitzy operations and go, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. And this is so cool. And love to be part of this, which is great, by the way. I mean, people love that. And, what you were experiencing was not sort of the glamour, but, as I recall, I mean, it wasn't grungy, but it was the gritty realism of agriculture and the product in front of you. Is that fair?
Oh, 100%. Christian, who was a few years older than me at the time, this was 1999, he had just taken over winemaking. He was 14th generation to be making wine in that estate. His hands were dirty from pressing grapes, from cleaning barrels, from everything. And that to me was the, if you can talk about the romantic side of wine, which I think is such a tiny, tiny piece, that to me was the romantic side of a lifestyle or an involvement with agriculture. He was, out in the fields pruning or tying or whatever he was doing, came in, did our tasting, and I knew that he was back out running the vineyards, and that to me was what I had been searching for, I think, and could see myself doing into the future. And it took, graduating, it took a little stint where I met Oscar, and then
tell people who Oscar is.
Oscar Binka is our business partner at the winery, one of my dearest friends. He and I met the last day of classes at Cornell, and we ended up working together in this project in Binghamton. And during our time there, we said, okay, when we're done with this project here, we are going into the wine business. I don't know how we're going to do it. I don't know what path we're taking, but we're going to do this. And so when we were done there, I cold called Herman. I sent my resume to through the mail to five wineries in Germany looking for an internship, and didn't hear anything.
Why Germany, by the way?
Well, I was fairly fluent in German. I knew I wanted to go back there. But the other part of it, I did not want to go the route of graduate work and advanced degrees. I knew that I wanted to train and apprentice in it. And I thought that was my vision of making wine, that it was a craft that's something you learned by doing, watching, tasting, versus something that you you studied for.
Sure. And at the time, by the way, how much had you grown up drinking wine, and how much did you feel like you understood wine?
Very, very little, in our family. I mean, we were a dairy family, and wine was for cooking, and wine was at special events. But not much more than that. But that, I don't think, to your point, growing up in a non-wine region and really a non-wine culture, the path into it was really from the ag side.
Yeah, I, and by the way, I should mention, I mean, having met the whole family involved here, Tim and Sandy, Phil and mm-hmm. Rita are also intimately involved, and it has become very much a family operation. And whether they're listening or not right now, mm-hmm. they should get some of the love here too, because I know that there's no way an operation like yours functions as fully and flowers as beautifully without everybody involved. They also have very good palates. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised that in taste and drink more wine grown up, given the strides they've made. But hey, so that's interesting. And was Oscar different? This is something I don't know about Oscar. Did he come into wine earlier than you did?
No, we came
because
into
your palate is much better than his.
Of course it is. That's correct. sorry, Oscar. But no, he came into it basically the same time I did, and maybe just from, you know, from his view of what his career would be on the sales and promotion and the business side of the wine business. Our passion of sitting down and having a glass of wine and talking about it was the common thread, and that continues to be the common thread. After that, it is it is, you know, I go to the vineyard and the winery, and he goes and works wholesalers and works the tasting room. But it's ironic, because I was on the business side of agriculture, he was on the agronomy side of agriculture as undergrads, mm-hmm. or graduate work also for Oscar. So that part has flipped for us.
Yeah, and I should mention to listeners, if you're just joining us, talking to Fred Merworth from Herman J. Wehmer, who is the winemaker and co-owner there. He's the 2021 Winemaker of the Year in Wine Enthusiast magazine, the first time a winemaker from the Finger Lakes has earned this honor. And so, so Fred, you know, you and Oscar become fast friends, and you decide this is something you want to pursue. You send resume, you said five German wineries. What did you hear?
I heard nothing for a month and a half, and that's when I got very nervous, because you know, I literally had been out of work. Oscar and I both had been out of work for maybe 3 weeks after this job. I'm like, this can't happen. And so I finally cold called Herman on a recommendation from a professor at Cornell. I said, just call Herman, see what he has to say. And I cold call him about seeking an internship in Germany.
And can I also just say, for listeners who don't know the full story, Herman is the eponymous Herman J. Wehmer. I mean, it is Herman from Germany. And so, Fred, you figured if anybody's got it in there, it's Herman.
Right. And I don't think anyone had prepared me for the cold nature of the call.
Do you want to elaborate on
yeah, that? So, I mean, he said, basically, I don't know anybody in Germany. I've been away so long, but why don't you come in and talk to me and see what we can figure out? There was no excitement about it. There was nothing warm and fuzzy about it. It was just, our relationship from the time I started there for several months was basically that type of interaction. I remember after I started with him, I started on March 23rd, 2001 with Herman, and he really didn't talk to me for about 2 weeks. And I just stood in the grafting room with other people, just debudding rootstock, which, you know, if anyone in the wine industry knows, you know, debudding rootstock is not the most glamorous job. I did that for 8.5 hours a day, with no talking or no discussion. You know, I think most people would have been done by that moment. Like, just, I'm not getting anything out of this. And I think for me, just looking at it from a big picture standpoint of, you know, I'm committed to learning this. It was sort of like the, Karate Kid, wax on, wax off, like, you know, or cleaning the deck. Like, I was just doing it. And then maybe 2 weeks later I could talk to Herman, well, why did I just do that for 2 weeks? You know? But now you know how to debud rootstock. Great. Perfect. All right. On to cleaning tanks. So, you know, and yet, that as a, I thrived in that, I'll be honest, because that was me, learning what I thought I was passionate about, which turned out to be true. And so I was able to watch, have learned from other people working there. And then finally, once Herman realized that I was committed to doing it, that's when he opened the door. And I remember him asking, hey, do you want to stay after and have a glass of wine? Whoa, wait a second. Yes. You know? So,
and so that path, though, it wasn't obvious that you were going to stay there, because in your own mind, were you thinking, well, maybe eventually Herman will get me a connection to Germany, and that's where I will end up for a while.
Of course. I mean, you know, going through that, you hope that the light at the end of the tunnel is what you were wishing it would be. And so he and I had discussed during the summer after Harvest 2001, I was going to go off to Germany. I found out shortly thereafter that he has so many contacts in Europe, whether it's in glass makers, it's nursery.
He told you he
growers.
Didn't.
He told me he didn't, but that was just, you know, that was a cop out so that he wouldn't have to send some random guy that showed up on his doorstep to a friend of his and then realize that maybe it wasn't the best recommendation, you know? So it was a test in a way, you know. It was, hey, prove yourself and then maybe we'll see what happens. And it was funny because after Vintage 2001, things had completely changed with Herman, because someone who had been there with him for a long time left in the middle of harvest. So it was just Herman making wine, running vineyards with two or three other people, with a longtime business manager, and that was it. And so I stepped into this role of oh, by the way, here's the manual for the bottling line. It's in English, but it's translated from Italian. Good luck. No pictures. and so that was total trial by fire. Here, we're going to set up the filter. I'm going to show you once, and that's it. You're going to do it after that. You know, you know, looking back, I don't think I would be as well-versed in many aspects of the wine trade had I not gone through that trial by fire. So.
And so, talking to Fred Merworth from Herman J. Weimer on Seneca Lake about his start in wine that has become just a vital centerpiece of what's happening. I mean, if you think of the Finger Lakes wine region as what used to be sort of a small foothill, and now if it's growing into a mountain, at the top of that mountain is Herman J. Weimer. And certainly Herman himself is a big part of that and the standard that he set. But then this team that comes in and takes the reins from him has taken it to new heights here, culminating in Fred winning 2021 Winemaker of the Year in Wine Enthusiast magazine. That's an international award. By the way, Fred, I looked up the last 10 years of winemakers. I mean, I'm not going to quiz you. Are you aware of sort of where they come from?
Yes.
You've seen the list?
Yes, I've seen some of the list.
Just from the last 10 years. 2011, Bob Cabral from William Selyem in Sonoma. 2012 and 2014, I saw Charles Smith. Is that a misprint? Did he win it twice?
He won it twice. Yep.
Okay, Charles Smith in Washington State. Benoit Gouet in 2013 from Champaign. Mm-hmm. 2015 was Jean-Baptiste Lacayon of Champaign as well. Mm-hmm. 2016 was Swartland, South Africa's Andrea Molyneux. Right. 2017, Christophe Baron from KU's Vineyards. From Lodi, California, Adam Mettler in 2018, Dave Finney from Orange Swift in Napa Valley in 2019, and Greg Brewer, co-founder and winemaker of Brewer Clifton in California last year. So a lot of California, a lot of France, a lot of West Coast, and now Finger Lakes. And so that's just a snapshot of, I think that's a pretty good summation of where the wine press has been, and for good reason. I mean, some of it, you can complain you don't cover, journalists don't cover certain regions, but you also have to earn it. And I think over the last, well, frankly, about 50 years, the Finger Lakes has earned that sort of attention. And now Wiemer is on that map in a big, big way with Fred. So you guys decided in 2007 with Herman's retirement that you wanted to turn this into a big, big family show and take over on your own there. No pressure, right?
Yeah, no pressure at all. Well, you know, I remember back to the moment I told my parents that I wanted to jump into wine. And I think, you know, some people would have said, would have expected some pushback. Like, you know, really, they were so encouraging of me. And with all of their, just full, you know, best of luck to do it. I can't thank them enough for giving me that freedom to do it. So when we took over in 2007, I mean, that was 3 years of negotiating with Herman and figuring out how that transition was going to happen, because it is hard to move from the person, that represents the wine to a new person, certainly, especially with his name on the label. And I think that was the tricky thing for Oscar and Maurice and I to figure out, how to make that jump. So they wasn't, well, who's this guy? Or, you know, what just happened to Herman? And I think with the help of my parents, with Oscar and Maurice, and, you know, we really thought and worked very hard to make that seamless transition, not only with, you know, the Finger Lakes in general, but like good customers, whether it was New York City or good wine customer, private customers around the country, that there had been 6 years of training leading up to this, that it wasn't someone just came in and where's Herman now? And that was, to your question about pressure, you know, I think looking back, that was for me the biggest pressure point of, okay, so Herman's, you know, Herman was an advisor, certainly, but I remember the first day that I bottled sparkling, we did, in August of 07, we did 4,500 gallons, which is for us an enormous bottling of sparkling. And I called Herman. I'm like, Herman, you know, I did everything right. I know I did. Nothing's happening. There are no bubbles. Like, what's happening? Hey, Fred, just be patient. Okay. You know, another couple of days go by, I pulled another bottle, nothing. Okay. I'm a pretty patient person, but nothing's happening. You know, another week goes by and boom, they start popping. And so, you know, when I opened a bottle and so having that, maintaining that relationship, having Herman as an advisor, but then, you know, us as a team starting to transition away from Herman as the person to Herman, the winery, you know, Herman Wiemer, the winery was a lot of work. I can tell you, we continue to do that. Even today, of transitioning from the person And it's 15 years, 14 years down the road. It's not that hard of a discussion anymore, but, you know, we've had to craft that, certainly.
Well, after we take our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about the team. And I've got some feedback to share from listeners, and we'll get Fred's take on some of what listeners are saying, not only about his wines, but the region. We're also going to talk a little bit about what sets this winemaker and this winery apart. It is not Fred's style to tell you that what they're doing is the best or to denigrate any of his colleagues. That's not why he's here. But I do think it's fair to say that they chose Fred Merworth for a reason. They chose Herman J. Wehmer for a reason, for winemaker, International Winemaker of the Year in Wine Enthusiast magazine. And we're going to talk about maybe setting different standards and finding ways to push your limits and push a wine's limits and push agricultural limits when it's really, really tough. I mean, there's nothing more fun than working in a business that's totally reliant on weather, as Fred will tell you. But boy, do they find a way around it when things are tough and they produce really, really special stuff. So this is a fun conversation for us. Fred's at WEOS in Geneva, and we'll take our only break of the hour and right back with him next. Coming up in our second hour, a little wine this hour, a little beer next hour, and some tough news for Rochester and especially the beer scene. The Tap and Mallet is closing after 14 years in Rochester's South Wedge, 14 years of building a thriving community of beer lovers and friends, and frankly, family. We're going to talk about the decision to close and what happens next in that space. Coming up next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Listener writes in, listening to the conversation with Fred Merworth, winemaker and co-owner of Herman J. Wehmer, a vineyard winery on Seneca Lake. Listener says, we had a bottle of his Riesling last night at Red. So happy to see Finger Lakes wines more and more in the Rochester area at restaurants. I still think our local restaurants could do a better job of promoting Finger Lakes wines. Fred, I mean, a couple decades in your work here, Rochester is not a city that, you know, if you sort of fell out of the sky into a city, you didn't know where you were in the world, you wouldn't go to a restaurant and think, oh, you are in the heart of a glittering wine region that makes great stuff. You might think, oh, there's something sort of tangentially related. But it's not a European model that way. And it maybe never will be. But I am curious to know if you think that it has grown or if it should grow. If there's any sort of obligation or reason for Rochester restaurants to do more to put Finger Lakes wines on those lists.
You know, in starting with Herman and actually when I started with Herman, going out on the road and doing tastings and working with distributors, it was clear his frustration about where the region was in terms of promoting and selling New York wines was pretty evident. Besides Ithaca. But what was the tell there for me was that Herman was in Ithaca all the time. He has friends there. He had restaurant friends. He had great connections at Cornell, and he was in restaurants and he was in wine shops all the time, almost harassing them to make sure they had their wine displayed properly, his wines displayed properly and pouring at the right temperature, to the point of sometimes people even taking it off the list because he would badger them so much. But that's what it took. And still, I think Oscar will tell you it, and anybody in the wine trade, it takes constant effort to make sure that you're creating the market, because the market's not always going to just sit there and say, okay, let us have it. And I think part of our, doing what we do and consistently doing what we do and trying to raise the level of quality and awareness for Finger Lakes is to make it hard for a restaurant buyer, a wine shop, to say no to the wines. Mm-hmm. And that takes time. That takes years. It takes many, and it's not just one producer that does it. And I think, if you look at how Napa and Sonoma have evolved, that is 30 years in the making, if you will, plus or minus. And Napa as a wine hub, or Sonoma, Healdsburg as wine hubs, didn't just happen in 5 years. There's an infrastructure and, a general push that has to happen. And that's, you know, coming back to where we are now in the Finger Lakes, I think we're in that movement. I think we're in that mode of seeing the investment, seeing the infrastructure to support a wine trade. And that's going to continue to move out of our 25 mile radius, out of our 50 mile radius.
So is it fair to say that you feel that, you know, maybe restaurants should be paying attention, but you don't want to feel entitled.
Correct.
That you want to earn it and you want to make them say, we've got to have you.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And I think, again, reflecting on Napa and Sonoma as a model, they did that. They forced, you know, restaurants in San Francisco to carry them because the quality was there and the demand was there. And I think we're getting to that point, outside of our Ithaca, Geneva kind of framework, that Rochester's, it's going to happen. It still takes, you know, more producers, consistent quality of wines, and a push from our region to say, hey, you've got to carry our wines here. And you know, having people come and taste in the Finger Lakes and then go back to Rochester or back to Syracuse will ultimately create that demand.
I want to talk a little bit about the team, not just to give you a chance to give credit, but I think this will be interesting to listeners just to hear what sort of a division of labor is like, because there's a lot of labor that goes into creating a world-class winery. And Herman J. Wiemer also took on the very wise expansion of Standing Stone on the other side of Seneca Lake, primarily because Fred didn't really want to see his wife anymore. And so Marisa is brilliant, and in so many ways is sort of the brains and the grounding rod of the operation. She's a brilliant designer. She's a jewelry maker, has been on this program talking about her work separately, and is really brilliant in her own right. But she does so much, kind of help oversee the operation over at Standing Stone. You have an assistant winemaker. You've got so many people in the operation there. Give us a sense for what that picture looks like, because I know your name's on this award, but it's not just you.
Yeah, and I think from the moment this was announced, you know, I wouldn't stand there and, you know, Evan, you mentioned it. I wouldn't stand there and say, this is great for me. This is such a reflection of many years as a team, consistently producing wines and striving for just better, just being better. And, you know, when we took over from Herman, I keep referencing that, but that was a time, you know, Oscar, Marisa, myself, and two other people at the winery, we could do virtually everything. We could mow the lawns. I could clean the tanks. We could plant grapevines. You know, it took some help. Certainly my parents were there, obviously. It took help, but we were not going to make the strides and make the push that we wanted to on a lot of different fronts without growing the business. And that included expanding the acreage, growing the nursery, and then, you know, led us to taking over Standing Stone in 2017. And that takes an unbelievable team to pull off. And you know, 2013, I was just transitioning from being all in on the winery to saying, man, I really need help. And coming through a fairly tricky vintage of 13, there was Dylan Buckley, like, I'm ready to tackle this as an intern, ready to learn. And I hadn't experienced that before, of somebody who was like virtually all in, like, and so Dylan is now
kind of like you, right?
Exactly like me. And Marisa's like, here's someone who's ready to learn it and teach it. And I can see, like, in hindsight of Herman being nervous about those first couple months of like, okay, is this real? Do they really want to do it? Am I going to put my time in and end up with someone who just moves on? But you know, Dylan took the reins, and we've worked together since, and he's making wine with me now and working hand in hand on the wine side. Brianna Kramer started in 2018 as an intern. She's there now as a assistant winemaker, doing a lot of the moves and part of the decision making. And then moving from 63 and a half acres in 2007 to 135 acres now, you know, it takes a really dedicated team, from Thijs van Sugeren in the vineyards, to Patrick and someone who's been there almost as long as I have, Tom Hainsworth. He started in 2002. You know, our evolution as a company could not have happened without really great people around us in the production side. And then moving that to the sales and marketing with Jenny at the helm, with Oscar, Teresa, our whole tasting room staff. Oscar told me not to thank people, so I'm going against his advice here. But he said, don't just sit there to thank people. But, you know, you don't get to 135 acres and I think continuing to push boundaries without really great humans around you. You just don't do it.
And here's one of the reasons I ask. You're at 135 acres now, is that right?
Yes.
What was the operation in 2001?
2001, Josef was in production, but Magdalena was in its first fruit year. So in theory, we were at 40 acres producing.
So you've more than tripled in size.
Yes.
How many cases of wine now versus how many cases 20 years ago?
We are at 25 to 30,000 cases. And at that point, a lot of Herman's production was just based on HAW, the original vineyard sites, and really riding the wave of what Winters dealt us. And that was, some years he was at 8,000 cases, some years he was at 3,000 cases. And he always used the nursery as a buffer to balance out from a business standpoint.
Yeah, because accountants love when you don't know if you're going to make 8,000 or 3,000 cases.
Exactly, right.
Banks love that. So you've grown a lot in that way. So if I asked you and your team to make 1,000 cases of wine, just 1,000, you would blow people away the way that you've been doing it with the whole team there for 20 years. You found a way to continue at that level, even though you've almost essentially tripled in size. But if I asked you to do 1,000,000 cases, you probably couldn't do it, not right now. And that would sort of stress or break the quality level. What's a reasonable target that you could still grow into? And is this roughly it for a while?
I think coming through 17, 19, now 21, 20 was a relatively easy vintage, but 17, 18, 19, 21, have had its challenges of, and every vintage is going to have that, of, of how much can you take in, how much can you take in at the moment that you want to take it in at the quality level that you're striving for. And I think now, working through 135 acres, we're also managing a 50 acre block. I didn't mention that, but we're managing a 50 acre block in addition to the 135. I think 25 to 30 is our peak. I think that is where what Dylan and I and Thijs and Brianna and Patrick, what we think we can handle, to continue to end up with wines like we have out of 2021. That was a really difficult vintage, but also the whole portfolio of wines that are coming out of 2020, it forces you to evaluate your efficiencies. It forces you to be realistic about why you're harvesting or when you're harvesting. Maybe if this block is going for off dry Riesling, I can machine pick that versus hand pick. And what does it take to get that block into a position to machine pick versus how we've always done it with hand picking? Those are the decisions that I think have changed slightly, going from, say, 15 to 18,000 where we were prior to Standing Stone to where we are now. But the thing that we are not going to lose focus on is how we pick, how we handpick well over 90% of our fruit, and how we strategize about the cost benefit of leaving things out. What quality are we shooting for? And I've always thought about this in our production, where you strive for your whole production to be of reserve quality. And by doing that, when you have an off vintage, you aren't just harvesting or just bringing fruit in to get it in. You're still through the glass of how do I maximize my quality for this vintage? And that allows you to get through a tough vintage and still look around and still taste barrels and tanks and be like, man, that is really good, even though it rained for 60 days straight. You know, it forces you to strive to be excellent when the conditions aren't. And so that's something that I think above 30, I think we'll lose that edge.
Okay. Let me read an email from a listener named Andrew, who says, Evan, I've been growing grapes and making wine on a personal level for 30 years. My growing area is tiny and on a friend's land off Lake Erie, way south of Buffalo. I've had some successes and some failures, all on a small scale. When I started out, I thought it was going to be easy. I soon found out that it is extremely hard work. One is at the mercy of Mother Nature for the growing of the grapes. Even if one has done well with the grapes, something can and often does go wrong with the winemaking process. Factor in early and late freezes that can kill vines, and one may need to start over. As I mentioned above, my scale is tiny. I can only imagine what the pros like Fred have to go through to grow grapes, make the wine, pay the employees, then make a living for themselves. I salute Fred. Thanks for doing the voodoo that you do so well. That is from Andrew. It's not voodoo, Andrew, but I want to talk a little bit about, I don't want to ask you this in a way that makes you feel like you're being asked to boast that you are better than your neighbors, etc. So I want to, because I know that's not your style, but the reality is you don't get chosen for this if you're not doing things better than most and different than most. I'm not going to say all, because I know you want to be careful with that, but tell me what you think really does set Weimer apart.
I think back to how I was expressing how we think about working through a vintage, of maximizing the quality on that reserve level, that's a critical piece of it. The hand picking is a critical piece, and sorting the fruit has, from 2007-2008, where we were just looking at fruit roughly, to where we were able to produce a vintage like 14 and 16 and 17, where if it's not me, it's Dylan, it's Brianna, it's Marisa, looking at virtually every cluster that comes onto the press pad. And so at that point, if your fingers, if your hands aren't involved in it, and it's just fruit moving across the press pad, you're going to miss the opportunity to make selections, to find quality levels, to find things that you don't want in your presses. I think that's something that I really believe to be a quality mark is we are in, not that other people aren't in constant contact with their fruit or, but I think with me still being present on virtually every load that comes onto the press pad and making decisions in the field of what we actually want to receive, it completes the cycle. It never happens where you have a bin of grapes and you're like, well, what happened here? If that happens, it's already too late. And so from how fruit's selected to the pressing process, I think Dylan and Tace would all agree that being hands-on is critical. You know, we moved into, starting 2004, into completely natural fermentation. It took about 10 years to get there.
Can you give a 30-second description of what that means?
Yeah, so we've removed all cultured yeast from our production except for the secondary fermentation on sparkling. So there's no cultured yeast. Everything basically starts on its own.
And why is that possibly a benefit?
Well, where we wanted to get to was, how do you best express your vineyard sites with the minimal, as few inputs and as few as little impact from the human as you can. And that has been a constant trying to figure that out. You know, terroir, the expression of terroir, I always feel the most important aspect of terroir, the last element of terroir is always the human influence, but that's actually the most impactful. The decisions that we make from picking to planting to yeast cultures that we're using, barrels. So how do you remove the human element from it? And so working back from that, we said, okay, we have to do natural fermentation. Herman and I started in 2004. Finally, by 2009, all the Rieslings were naturally fermented. 2016, all the reds were fermented naturally. That takes you back to what's coming in on the fruit is what's going to conduct the fermentation. And that's going to be unique to every single vineyard site. And we've done some trials with Cornell on trying to figure out what yeast are conducting the fermentations. And they are unique to every single vineyard site, which is super exciting. You know, using very little sulfur, if any, prior to fermentation. This vintage in particular, where it was a very difficult vintage, we used absolutely no sulfur on the press pad. That sets you up later on after your fermentations for wines with very low sulfur, something I'm very proud of. We've moved into biodynamic farming on 33 acres, which is a huge swath of land. And that is, you know, I can't talk highly enough about Tace and the team he's working with to bring that to the press pad to now where we have five vintages in a row of biodynamically grown Riesling, in a region that is really tough. So, you know, I think to finish answering your question, I think we risk where we can. We strive for reserve quality no matter what. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose at the quantity game of that. But that makes it so that regardless of your vintage, you still end up wines that you're proud of.
Nick in Fairport sends me a picture, Fred. He says, in my 50-degree root cellar, I still have these two bottles, a 2002 Weimer Pinot and a 1999 Weimer Old Vines Pinot Noir. It says Old Ooh. Vines on the label. I'm looking at it. I didn't Ooh. Know that used to, some of your labels used to say Old Vines.
Yes.
They probably weren't that old at the time. Maybe. Maybe for the region. It's all relative, right? What would you tell Nick and Fairport about those two wines, 99 and 02 Pinots?
The 02 is okay. We tasted the bottle a couple, probably beginning of harvest. That's okay. The 99 is probably drinking great. That was from an old block right by the winery. Yeah, old. I mean, what's old? Those were planted in 1982.
So 17 years at the
17
time.
17 years.
Yeah.
Old was 17 years.
What's old vines in Europe, by the way?
Oh, man. You know, you're in the 75 to 80 year range pretty easily.
It's all relative, right? but those probably drink them sooner than later, right?
I would definitely crack the O2.
And the shoulder fill looks really good. So, Nick, that is super cool stuff.
Yep.
And I hope you really enjoy that. And by the way, Nick, or anybody listening, if you find bottles that have a decade or two of age, even if they're not perfect, that's a really beautiful experience because that's a way to transport yourself for a moment back to, frankly, now, a pretty different time. So I hope you enjoy that, and that's really special for you, Nick. Fred, in the last minute or so here, I guess I just want to ask you, you know, what some of our listeners have been asking about. Can you keep doing this with climate change that make it harder? Can you give us a sense in this last minute how you think the work has changed with climate? Keep it to a minute.
Yeah. So where winter damage has always been one of our Achilles heel, I think that's still going to happen. We don't see it as much, so that's a positive. Where in 21 in parts of 19, certainly 18, the increased amount of moisture, that is something that we're going to, I think, continue to experience. That is very different than 15 years ago. You know, as in viticulture, in agriculture, it's something that really is very difficult to farm biodynamically and organically with the amount of moisture that we have. So it's going to really test us. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. It's really going to test us to see if these methods are obtainable.
Congratulations again. I know that you feel about awards the way I sort of do about journalistic awards, which is just to say, I know you appreciate it. I know it's not the thing that you want to blare out to the world, but we're happy to do it for you and the whole team at Wiemer. Fred is the 2021 Winemaker of the Year in Wine Enthusiast Magazine. He's the winemaker and co-owner of Herman J. Wiemer on Seneca Lake. Thanks again, my friend.
Evan, thank you very much. This has been wonderful.
That's Fred Murrewarth joining us from WEOS Studios in Geneva and Finger Lakes Public Radio. More connections coming up in a moment.